Beautiful.
Alrighty. Fuck it. Come on.
I'm happy with finding that free music. I feel like it works pretty well.
I love it.
Welcome back to Sword, Sorcery, and Socialism, a podcast about politics and themes hiding in our genre fiction. As always, I am Aurora, and I'm joined by my co-host, Ketho. How's it going, Ketho?
Ready.
We are back, and we lied to you. This isn't a book. I'm sorry. But our brains have been absolutely ruined by it for some time now, and so we're going to talk about it anyway. And the themes are good enough that we can tie it back to Cyberpunk Month from a year and a half ago. So we're talking about it anyway. Technically, there are books, but we're not covering them. We are talking about Cyberpunk 2077, the video game. And to talk about it with us, we are joined by a returning guest. It is Roberto from the Czar Power podcast and the History of Sarkatvelo, Georgia. Welcome back, Roberto.
Howdy. I just still cast those things. But...
no, that's my thing.
Both say howdy.
I'm from Texas. I think it's more culturally appropriate.
Dang it, it makes more sense coming from you.
Ketho's actually doing cultural appropriation from you.
I'm Appalachian.
So Roberto, I believe everyone might remember Roberto was on our episodes about the Wheel of Time, I think.
Yes. Not long ago.
And also in the shared episode we did about We by
Yevgeny Zamyatin.
Yeah, that one. Yeah. I'd get there. So Roberto is back, and we are going to talk about the video game Cyberpunk 2077 by CD Projekt Red that released, I don't know, a few years ago, but it essentially re-released recently with like a 2.0 version with an updated story and gameplay and a bunch of other things. And it's completely ruined our brains. And there was no way we were going to continue being able to like do books without talking about this, because the three of us have been talking about this almost exclusively for like 2 months. So
I mean, yes.
We are going to talk about morality, the self, survival, I don't know, a bunch of other really important things that we are, a lot of them are, will be callbacks from what we talked about when we did Cyberpunk Month and did Neuromancer and Ghost in the Shell and
Snow Crash, the really bad one.
sort of. And, you know, Akira and some other stuff, but mostly Neuromancer and Snow Crash and Ghost in the Shell, I think, are the ones that are going to be the most appropriate here. Mm-hmm. But so, as always, spoiler warning. If you haven't finished the game yet, what the hell are you doing with your life? Go do that before you listen to this probably two-part episode, because we are going to spoil a lot of the endings and a lot of the sort of personal choices you can make throughout the campaign. And being for myself, it is one of the probably top three video games I've ever played. So, I don't know. Don't spoil the endings for yourself, probably. Go play it, then come back. We'll still be here. Hang on, wait, we'll give you a second. Hold on. Okay, you beat it. Congratulations. Welcome back.
Well, if you're like me, it took me about... Well, for me, it took me about 4 years and 217 hours to beat it, so...
I did a little faster than that, but hey. So,
Do you like it? Good.
Yeah, I mean, how do you... First off, as we do with any, like, work we talk about, how did you two feel about this piece of media?
Okay, so I've been playing it since 2020, and when it first came out, I thought that it was something completely new that would be in my field of interest, because it's futuristic enough but not too far. It's in a near distant future, and I thought, okay, this looks good, and you know, CD Projekt Red hasn't let me down before. Played it day one, and it ran great. Everyone who was complaining is because you guys were using old consoles that weren't meant to run that shit. So that's your problem and your fault. PC, you know, I used the PC. It worked. I built it just for Cyberpunk. So let's go. But you know, it ran great. I've gotten so close to beating the game on like 6 playthroughs, and I finally decided to just do it this time, especially with the DLC. So it made it much fun.
Gello?
I didn't have anything I could play it on when it first came out. I had a PS4, but I wasn't going to try and run it on PlayStation 4. It was not worth it. And that being said, I was a huge fan of CD Projekt Red. So, but I don't know. I saw the fallout and the whatnot that surrounded it, and I didn't touch it again until you started talking about it. And then I was like, well, I guess I'll play it. I've seen good things. Also, for those of you who know who this is, Josh Sawyer, one of the lead production designers for Fallout New Vegas and a handful of other games for Obsidian Entertainment.
Fallout New Vegas, both Pillar of Eternity games, and yes. Pentiment.
And he was on record talking about how much he enjoyed the game after it came out with its updated patch and Phantom Liberty, because it kind of transformed the game completely in terms of how the gameplay itself functions into something that made a lot more sense to me looking at it from the outside. Especially, and I'm going to bring this up. This is such a pointless thing to bring up, but the fact that they made armor not tied to your apparel, so I could play dress up.
Look, yes, I love look, that.
All three of us are guilty of playing a lot of dress up.
Oh yeah, no, I have 6 different outfits.
Yeah, did I use all 6 outfit slots and change them depending on the mission I was doing and who I was talking to? Yes. What car I was driving? Yes. Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm going to go see Judy, am I going to wear something really nice? Absolutely.
It's you got to have an outfit. After Phantom Liberty, did I keep
Aurora's outfit?
Yeah, Aurora's outfit to put on for special occasions? Obviously. Yes. It rules.
I think it's funny that, I don't know, I just look at all the clothing in it and I'm like, wow, can this be like socially acceptable to wear?
Oh my God, if I could wear some of those outfits in public now?
Usually the tech jackets with the cool neon.
I want those so badly.
Like the high collar ones, you know?
Uh-huh.
Like the David jacket or whatever.
Like the David or like the replica of the samurai jacket would be a really cool one to have.
Look, I'll be honest, I kind of have the same problem with the samurai jacket that a lot of people had like about a decade ago with the jacket from Drive, where you're like, it's really sick, but it would also be really cheesy to actually wear it in public.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. I don't care.
But you know what I mean, where you're like, I would wear this, but also it's like...
It's like when you see people wearing like the anime clothes in public and you're like, all right, you shouldn't, you know...
That's what I mean about it being socially acceptable, though. It just needs to become socially acceptable.
If we just start doing it, we can be the change you want to see in the world.
We can dress up as Johnny.
I know. I'm going to start wearing the cutoff, you know, that like Judy wears that you can get with some of the outfits that cuts off like, you know, like midriff with like weird leather pants. Let's go.
So some of the boots in this game, mm-hmm. This is so unimportant for what we're going to be discussing, but there's these sets of heeled boots that mm-hmm. are solid color metal. They look like composite.
Yeah.
Like it's like some sort of plastic composite material. Boots that come up to like mid thigh.
Yes. And you're like, how do you wear those?
they're like violent. Like I have 2 outfits in the game, and I'm playing as a woman because they have better fashion options. But
I think we should say for the record that all three of us played female V this time.
My male V is the backup V. The one I'm going to play as another playthrough.
Like I played female V for obvious reasons, but I also know a lot of people end up playing female V because they like her voice acting better, which I agree with.
Well, it's for me, it's the same voice actress from Persona 5 for Makoto. So mm-hmm. I really like that character, and I was like, yeah, I can play as her now. This is awesome.
Yeah, I think the female voice sounds like kind of husky and like cool, where the male V sounds like a dude kind of trying to be edgy. But that's just
that is the same. That is the same voice actor for Makoto, isn't it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome because best girl.
Right? Right?
Persona 5. And then
so
V, best girl
in this game. So I got us on this hype train because I kicked this off because I heard I bought this game on release. And I was one of those people that could barely play it because it didn't really load and my car kept flipping into the stratosphere and a bunch of other stuff. Right. And I was like, whatever this is, you know, got burned, but I owned it. So it just sat in my Steam library forever. And eventually I saw some of the same things online, people being like, oh no, like there's a 2.0 and this DLC is like phenomenal. The game is good now. And I was like, I'm looking for a new game to play, downloaded it, started playing it, and it blew my fucking mind. We'll talk about it, but the Phantom Liberty DLC, which is one that occurs like within the structure of the game, it's not like a after thing, is some of the tightest and most compelling writing and mission design I've ever seen in like an RPG.
This is just CD Projekt Red's forte.
Like, they really hit their stride.
As someone who has been a big fan of The Witcher 3 for a long time, mm-hmm.
It's like Blood and Wine, right? Where like they finally hit
their DLC. Both their DLC for that game are absolutely fantastic. Blood and Wine is better than Hearts of Stone, but Hearts of Stone still has this really incredibly written villain.
He is one of my favorite villains of all time.
It's almost like CD Projekt Red, like they make the game, and then by the time they're working on a DLC, they finally really settled into the groove of like how to make the game feel just right. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Like they're usually under less of a time pressure.
Yes. They're usually under less of a crunch. Yeah. Well, they spent
almost all the assets that they need.
And they spent how many years what I want to give them for this game, for 2077, is they essentially spent years overhauling the entire game. So even though it only has one DLC, it sort of has two because they overhauled the entire base game.
Well, I'll even say that Cyberpunk started getting really good by the Edgerunners update, which is like 1.5, 1.6.
Mm-hmm.
Because when the Edgerunner show came out, we're not going to talk about that today, but when that came out, they updated the game and made it a lot tighter. And then 2.0 came out with the Phantom Liberty stuff, and that just made it like the best thing ever. So it was already, they were getting there, and it was very playable by 1.5. And then 2.0 is just like made it perfect.
So we're going to talk about a number of things related to we're going to cover a sort of range of topics here, both sort of political and sort of moral questions raised by the game as the game presents them to you. And then I personally want to, because it's something I've gone out of my way to look at for this game specifically, is then look at moral and political and ethical questions and the way that the player base has reacted to them. Because I think that provides us a lot of interesting data, because there's a lot of things that I think the game presents pretty well and lets you make choices. But I've noticed the way a lot of players of the game react to the questions and prompts that the game gives you that I think provides a lot of interesting information. And so I have been spending a lot of time in unsavory places like Cyberpunk subreddits and forums to try and get a feel for how the community has reacted to certain aspects of the game. And I want to talk about that because I have some thoughts, as I often do. But I think we can start probably by talking more about the game itself. One thing you were obviously we immediately started talking about outfits. One thing I think this game does really well, which is I think both a good and bad thing that cyberpunk as a genre does, is it makes it look really fucking cool. Okay.
Mm-hmm. This is the link to something like Snow Crash, as much as I hate it.
Yeah.
Is that Snow Crash put a lot of effort into making the aesthetic seem like an aesthetic. Like
that it's what I call that Snow Crash does what I call cyberpunk as like set dressing. You're not doing a cyberpunk story the way you and I would probably talk about it on the podcast, but you're using the aesthetics of cyberpunk because they're cool.
Yeah. There's like the whole, everything like living in a shipping container and stuff like that. Like it's very industrial. It's very, the main character in Snow Crash rides around on a bike all the time.
Or rides around on a motorcycle with a katana. Like,
why does it sound like my build? I think
what Kethla's getting at here is that like this game sort of rides the line between what I would call like classic sort of cyberpunk like fiction from like a good like thematic and narrative perspective, like Neuromancer or Ghost in the Shell or something, but it still has a lot more thematic content that is on par with actual like cyberpunk novels, while still doing the aesthetic thing of Snow Crash of making it really, really cool.
So what I'm seeing is that it takes a happy medium of still bringing out those points, but making it really freaking cool at the same time, because you're trying to appeal to a market base. So you want the cool aesthetics.
Yeah. Cause like, if you read Neuromancer, it fucking sucks.
I didn't read it. There.
Like, how do you guys? It's true. But like in what I call the more like thematically appropriate cyberpunk fiction, mostly what it talks about is how much it sucks. Cause that's the whole point, is that this hyper capitalist, hyper exploitative world sucks to be in.
And you see those themes throughout the game.
Yeah. Those themes are present throughout the game.
Yeah. They're present throughout the game. And you see every time you see the situation, like, you know, the corporals are doing just fine. If you're top tier, if you're like mid tier, you're, especially if you start off with the corporal life path in the beginning of the game, you're a second, you know, you're close to getting cyberpsychosis and having a mental breakdown from all the drugs you're taking and stimulants.
I mean, one of the ads you see across the city is a guy with a gun in his mouth. And it's like, you feel like killing yourself? Try these instead. You can keep your life and your career.
Yeah. And then you see like the abject poverty just around the whole area. When you're riding around or you're going through several different sectors, and it's like, oh, people here are suffering a lot.
It's much more stylish than what you would get in something like Neuromancer or even something like, it's weird saying it's more stylish than the Matrix, but it is, it's flashy. Yeah. It's like neon punk, aesthetic. And if you think back to like Neuromancer and you think back to even something that would be considered more like proto cyberpunk, like something like Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?
Yep.
Like those books are borderline post-apocalyptic, not so much let's look at how cool this aesthetic is.
This almost rides closer to Blade Runner the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And Blade Runner 24,
I would say
Blade Runner 2049, where you have a lot more neon, you have a lot more flash. It's still dirty, it's still dystopian, but there's more pizzazz to it. Like Night City is all neon except for the parts that are post-industrial wasteland,
which are all the poor parts of the city.
Yeah. Or the giant infinite pile of trash just outside of the city.
Oh man.
Which if you get your car stuck in, you're screwed.
Oh yeah. You just got to walk out.
And no matter where you go, you can always turn around, look back at the city, and see the giant, like, sky-scrolling advertising boards that are just constantly showing you ads. It's, for me, that is actual hell.
No, and the worst part is, in your own apartment, the base apartment you get, you can never turn off the advertisement board. Ever.
No.
The one that's like circling like above your couch.
Yeah, yeah, you can never turn it off.
No, it's what this game gets. I think aesthetically, if we're talking like from the aesthetic point, what it gets right, I think, about this sort of dystopian, like cyberpunk, you know, capitalist hellscape, constant ads, inescapable advertisements for products that even past first glance are awful. It's like, the ads are for things, you notice the products available in the world are either hyper violent,
hypersexual,
or meant to distract you from all the rest of those things. Mm-hmm. And that's all they provide. It's either like everything is hypersexualized and hyper, like, I don't know, like what, profitized or whatever. So it's like, oh, I mean, you're a corpo. You need to take these so you can perform better at work. Oh, is that burning your brain out? Well, then you need to take this so you can, like, you know, get your rocks off when you get home after work so you don't want to blow your brains out. Also take these drugs so you can sleep. It is, they do a good job of presenting a capitalist world essentially turned up to 11. You know, like, it's awful from an objective perspective. Like, it's pure ads. It's pure consumption. That is your only freedom as an individual, is the freedom of consumption.
And the similar way that I think a lot of capitalist structures are very seductive aesthetically. Like if you think of the classic, like 19, like the nuclear family home, like the old traditional, like, I mean, mostly made to sell houses.
The white picket fence and all that.
The white picket fence sort of thing, where it's very enticing, like, from an aesthetic standpoint. And I think that reflects pretty well in the actual game being flashy as hell, and the aesthetic being cool as fuck.
it is enticing. You're like, oh, I want to wear these cool clothes and ride around on my sick motorcycle with a katana, like looking at like the neon signs and listening to the radio, and you're like, this is cool. What I think this game does, the writing of this game does get that Snow Crash didn't, is that that is a facade. That is an intentional marketing gimmick to make you buy into a world that really fucking sucks. Because you see it when you're looking at it like this. And then the minute you actually try to like do anything, like you go on a mission or do a job, you realize how awful it is for everybody else. Mm-hmm. Every mission is like, oh, you got to help this guy. He went to the wrong bar one time and got kidnapped, and they're going to chop his fingers off to turn him into like a BD slave. Can you go rescue him real quick? And you're like, excuse me? He what?
Yeah, some of those gigs, like especially some of the gangs where you run into like the scavs who are like kidnapping people and then taking their cybernetic implants by force and then selling them on the black market.
The scabs, like, you live in a world where like having cybernetics, having, or the game calls it like Chrome, is almost necessary for a lot of people to perform their jobs, right? Like, obviously, we see it from the perspective of like a mercenary, where it's obviously necessary. But you know, a lot of corpos have it. A lot of other people have cybernetics. So you need cybernetics to do your job. But having it also makes you a target of these gangs who make a living by literally just yanking people off the street and chopping them to pieces to steal their cybernetics to sell on the black market.
Like, the first mission you play is literally rescuing someone from that exact same thing.
Rescuing someone who, by the way, has the highest level of protection you can purchase and still fell victim to scavengers. Sandra Dorsett has Trauma Team Platinum, which is the highest level of personal protection you can buy.
Mm-hmm. In a way, is that kind of like, if you think about it, is that kind of like a commentary on how, like our phones, like if you think about it, can we really, Is it possible to live your life without a phone? Yes. Yeah. We know that it's possible. It's been possible for 200,000 years. But at the same time, if you don't have one, how is work going to go?
Well, I've seen people argue that we essentially already have Chrome, cybernetics now because of our phones.
Yeah, if we can just get those implanted and just...
Yeah, like that's the whole thing. Like your character, that cybernetics that you can't remove in game is having your phone literally built into your brain.
Having a jack in your arm.
The UI is all cybernetics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the fact that you interact with computers by just like yanking a cord. It looks like a headphone jack out of my wrist. That gives me the ick so bad.
So bad.
Every time I see V do that and just put it in something, I'm like, why? Just why? And having slot to put cables into the back of your head, I'm like,
the idea that you just like, I'm going to interact with a random terminal I found in public. I'm going to yoink a 3.5 millimeter headphone jack out of my wrist and just plug it into a random data terminal.
It feels deeply unsanitary and also like it would feel incredibly gross as that thing is stored in your arm.
Yeah, it feels so. Can you imagine the feeling of like a retractable cable pulling back into your arm? Ugh.
I mean, my character's arms are mechanical at this point.
But see, that's the thing. I also
gorilla arms.
I also have never gotten any of the arm mods because they give me the same like body horror ick factor. It makes me deeply uncomfortable.
The one that makes me like, so I was like trying to figure out which, cause I filled up the cyberware and everything. And I was trying to figure out which one would go best. And the artistic design of the, specifically the like cannon that you can fit in your arm, the projectile launcher, when it's closed, it looks fine. And you're like, whatever, that looks kind of cool. It's like this cybernetic tattoo sort of thing. And then when you activate it, your entire like arm itself like splits open and the thing pops out and aims at people and then fires. And it's ludicrous.
Same with the Mantis blades. You know, you literally have like these blades coming out of your arms and your arms just spread out. And like the gorilla arms, when you're pushing things open, it just like breaks open. And I'm like, ah!
Yeah, see, I didn't install them because it grosses me out so much. Like, it's the same reason I never liked the Saw movies, right? Because that sort of body horror to me is awful. I can't stand it. So, like, I never did, in all my playthroughs, the arm mods because it gives me such, like, body horror, right? And then the idea that, like, people just give you stuff and you got to just, like, plug it into a slot in the back of your head, which, as is the main plot point, is a bad fucking idea.
Don't slot in random chips.
imagine you just meet somebody and they're like, hey, I got some like interesting information you might like. You're like, cool. And they're like, here, take this USB stick and plug it into the base of your skull. And you're like,
I mean, there's a whole mission about this.
Yeah, like, this is just making me have like horrifying images in my head of at work we get these like cybersecurity trainings and everything.
Yeah.
And we get fake phishing emails sent to us that we have to check. And I'm imagining just having to have those lessons, but about your own brain.
Don't put random data shards into your, that you find on the street, into your skull.
Click on dumb stuff. And how many people fall for phishing scams? Imagine if that was just being beamed directly into your skull at all times.
Yeah. Again, from a world building perspective, what Snow Crash missed, but I think 2077 gets, is that we've talked about before that one of the main things that makes Cyberpunk what it is taking a technology and like envisioning this future technology and then like looking at the repercussions of it, right? You know, and like Neuromancer, it's like the net running that he does, that sort of thing. In 2077, you have like sort of hyper like body mods and you, think about the issues it can cause or the ramifications. And that's kind of what we're getting around here is like, because you have cyberware directly implanted into your brain that you can't get rid of, that almost everybody has, you are literally have to be constantly aware and on the lookout for a cyber attack on your brain. There's a mission you do at one point to try and stop a guy from turning someone's lungs off because they've like gotten access to her system and can like literally just shut off her lungs remotely.
Which mission was this?
It's one of the ones in Dogtown, I'm pretty sure. Or someone's being blackmailed and he's threatening to shut her lungs off. Or
oh, something. Yeah, yeah. I remember that. Yep.
Like,
potentially have to work with the Net Watch guy versus, yeah.
It's the Net Watch guy versus one of like the Voodoo Boys, I think, or something like that. Yeah.
Well, it's the Voodoo Boys. They have it coming.
Yeah. But no, but I'm like, that concept that this game presents to you, as soon as why this is good cyberpunk in one level is because as soon as you think about it for more than 2 seconds, that's horrifying. Imagine if like, yeah, being aware of phishing emails is a thing you have to be worried about for your brain. Like anyone you interact with, any data terminal you have to plug into might just fry your brain completely.
Stop your heart.
Might stop your heart just because, mm-hmm. because they've got, cause they, the way that very first mission, Sandra Dorsett, again, has the highest level of protection you can buy with money. Cause she's a pretty high ranking corpo. The scav still found a way to jam the signal for her trauma team response. And so no matter what, they can just be like, oh yeah, the signal doesn't work in here. We can just kill you for with no repercussions. That is terrifying. And that sort of, it's the idea that like we, our bodies will continue to be like permanently online, that our lives will be permanently connected to this sort of network. This is the thought experiment about what that means, actually. And it means it's really bad. I mean, literally the world almost fell apart in the history of the cyberpunk world because of Bart Moss and like the first, like destruction of the first net. And you're constantly reminded throughout this game that without Netwatch watching the borders, like literally everyone could just die if the black wall fell and the rogue AIs just came in and fucked with everyone's brains. Like, that's just the thing you got to, like, the rogue AIs would just jump in and take over your body. And there's nothing you could do about it if the black wall ever came down. Like, this is a thing you legitimately need to be worried about.
And, like, it's a theme you see throughout the game as well, because there's a reoccurring character named Mr. Blue Eyes who shows up. And, like,
even who Mr. Blue Eyes is like,
we don't know. Thing. Like, we're thinking maybe he may show up, but they may have more to do in a sequel, but, like,
do you know I made it through my whole first playthrough without ever seeing the name Mr. Blue Eyes?
You didn't see during the Jefferson Peralta's mission?
They never say his name. Never say Mr. Blue Eyes.
Oh, he's standing off in a corner and just kind of watching you talk with Peralta's.
Yeah, I didn't see him. It's like I literally never saw him.
So playthrough. Is the, a little off topic, but is the assumption that Mr. Blue Eyes is the one who's doing all that manipulation to the Peralta's?
Yes.
Okay.
But the assumption it's him, but what you don't, you're assuming it's him. And on top of that, you don't know if he's doing it for himself or if he's doing it for
the AI Illuminati.
Yeah. For like the AI, or is he doing it for Night Corp? Like, you don't really know who he's.
Doesn't he also play into Somi's ending as well?
Yes.
I never got that information. I never got that confirmed that he's the one that she's dealing with. So I don't know where that information comes from. I've seen people say it, that he's the one she makes a deal with to get to the moon, but I don't know where that information is because I personally never saw it.
Well, and Gary the Prophet always talks about them, you know, blue-eyed aliens from Alpha Centauri.
Well, Gary says a lot of stuff.
Well, it all does. But it all makes sense. Because
the techno-vampires from Alpha Centauri.
Yeah, techno-vampires from Alpha Centauri, and it's just like, the blue eyes, and you see them, it's like, oh, shoot. Like, once you get further in the game, and the Sandra Dorsett mission, what you get afterwards, connects us to Gary the Prophet, which connects to the Paralysis mission. So those are all actually kind of connected. So you have these rogue AIs who have this mass conspiracy working.
Well, you also, Blue Eyes himself might also just be a rogue AI.
Yes, or like an AI proxy, if anything. Because he's always connected to the web. which is why his eyes always have the blue shimmering that is based off of when you're connecting to the internet.
Mm-hmm.
This is like a running theme, I think, for CD Projekt Red to contain these little like notes and secrets. Whenever you do end up playing The Witcher and you get to Hearts of Stone, they pulled that whole thing with Gontaro Dim too, where you're not really sure who he is, and then there's there's like a web of conspiracy around who this person is and what they represent, and I don't think they're ever going to answer the question. So as much as I would love to see Mr. Blue Eyes show up in Orion, I don't think they're ever going to answer it, because they're going to be sitting there like making these cool little puzzles for us to solve.
Yeah. But so what I was getting here, getting back around to the point where, like, if we're talking about the sort of the base stakes of the world that we're working with here, is incredibly awful. Like, some people are like, oh, it's cool. You can scan people with your eyes. You can do like net running, and you can do net running and fry people's brains before they even know you're there.
That's one of the play styles.
That's my play style.
It's a whole way to be a mercenary is to be essentially a quick hack net runner. So you can just like walk up to a crowd of people, do some little brain magic, and they all just die.
It's fun.
And there's nothing they can do about it. If you're just a person living in Night City, any random merc could just fry your brain.
System collapse.
They can just system collapse your head. And there's nothing you can do about it.
Haptic overload.
Yep.
Unless you're one of the people that's rich enough to have installed
self-ice.
Like self-ice, which is like essentially like virus defense or whatever for your brain, like anti-hacking for your own brain, which most people aren't rich enough to do. You can just be killed at any moment. And that's just from the cyberware stuff. Obviously, the city's also dangerous and you could just be shot at any time too. But like...
Well, like they say, the easiest thing to catch in Night City is a bullet in your back. That's literally one of the quotes from the game.
Yes. But like, and this goes into a problem that I often have with cyberpunk as a genre is, and it ties into a larger theme I'm going to be harping on a lot this year throughout our podcast and on the internet, if you follow me, is that media literacy is bad. Most people aren't good at it. At like reading media and like understanding what it means. And so many people will like play cyberpunk and go, hell yeah, tech, cool. It's not cool. It's very bad because everyone thinks that they're going to be a solo. Everyone thinks they're going to be the net runner. You're not.
You're going to be the random person walking around the city, going to a job.
You're not that person right now. You are not going to be that person in the future when this type of thing comes real. You're going to be that guy working on a construction site who gets his head cut off by a cyber psycho.
You're going to be the person who is trying to work their way into a better life by working for like Militech or something, and they work you. And if you look at their like, there's like books in the game that will describe the benefits packages for some of the businesses. It's like if you work for Militech or something, it's something like 100-hour work week.
Mm-hmm.
And a whole slew of other things. And it's like, wait a second. Even the people who are like, unless you are the very tippy top, even the people who are like,
well, in off.
A relatively secure position are working 100-hour work weeks and still have to pay for healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And like don't get time off or any of that stuff.
Like, and you see people who can't afford to buy, you know, trauma team anything, and it's like they're working every day of their life and they're like, yeah, still can't afford this, so they and get like, screwed over.
And like every scav den you go in, there's just dead people that they've just kidnapped for their chrome.
It's no wonder that people run off and join gangs like that.
That is, I think, one of the messages is that like the reason in Night City that I think that like gangs are so prevalent is because gangs represent an alternative structure. like an alternative societal structure, because the actual quote unquote legal structure of society does not work for most people. That which you could argue is true to some extent now in the world we live in, but that's why we're talking about this, because cyberpunk is taking current societal problems and projecting them into the future and to like expand them and to see sort of the repercussions. So if you look at a world where like the official structure of society, you know, be it, you know, the government of Night City or whatever, has failed most people, that like literally walking out of your door, there's like a significant chance that you will die just by leaving your house, right? Well, what do people turn to in these situations in real life, and that this game accurately models? This sort of community structure, whether you view it as positive or negative, gets taken over by other entities. And in this game, those entities are gangs, mostly.
Which, if you think about it, they're like the security for these lower classes, because especially in your neighborhoods, because they're all set to different locations. So lots of gangs don't like overlap in territory. And they're meant there to be there as a sort of systematic, because, you know, even going back like historically, gangs were formed to protect the community around them. And then, you know, they become more than that, because you don't mess with a Valentino. You know, you don't mess with, you know, the Moxies unless you're like another gang member. Because if you do, you're going to get screwed over.
Well, the Moxes are like the most clear example of a gang that formed for a purpose, for community defense. So like all the gangs sort of have their little territories. You know, the Valentinos have theirs. The Sixth Street have theirs. Like
Fuck Sixth Street.
Yeah, all of them have their territories. But the people within those territories, whether they like them or not, do rely on them some. Like there's one little mission you can do where you're like sitting in a diner and some people come in to rob it. And the guy that owns a diner complains. He's like, well, where the fuck? I pay Sixth Street to stop this shit from happening. What the fuck? And so like, whether you like them or not, these gangs do provide structure and a modicum of security for these communities. And again, the Mox are the most clear example of this, because they were formed specifically for the protection of sex workers, mostly by former sex workers, because they were not protected in any other way.
Very cool. The Mox are probably the most unambiguously positive gang.
Mm-hmm. They're like the only gang that's like isn't going out of their way to ruin people's lives.
Yeah, because I think they're the only gang you'd never actively kill.
No, you don't. You don't kill anybody.
You actually do some work through some of the fixers for the Mox.
Yeah, you've got the one. Yeah. You've got the one where you rescue the guy because one of the Mox girls went cyber psycho because of like a bad BD. A couple of the ones for like Regina or whoever, where you're killing some of the, or no, for Wakako, where you're killing Tiger Claw bosses. You're doing that for the Mox, like when you killed Jotaro.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then like there is a chance for you to kill some of the Moxies when you're doing the street races.
Yeah, but that's, I think the street races are like, oh, that weird gray area, because everyone's like, it's a free reign. We're going to talk about that later. Trust me.
Oh, I know.
For a whole different reason. But
yeah. But yeah, so with the Mox are predominantly, I think, the most chaotically good of the groups, because Scavs and Maelstrom on the bottom tier of that fucking list.
Yeah, Scavs and Maelstrom are at the bottom because they're the ones that actually kidnap people and destroy them. The Tiger Claws
for different reasons too, because the Scavs will steal all your chrome, and the Maelstrom will just add a bunch of chrome to you.
The Maelstrom will torture you and force chrome on you. Tiger Claws are bad because they're like they just run all the they run most of the brothels. And they do a lot of real fucked up stuff. Sixth Street are just racist.
They're your Proud Boys, if anything.
Yeah, they're sort of weird. It's weird to be a patriot in a world, especially like this, particularly when you're in a city that's not part of the USA, but whatever.
Sixth Street is, I watched a video that went into detail of the Cyberpunk Red factions. So they were a little bit different than they are in Cyberpunk 2077, but
well, because Red takes place in like technically a few years before that.
In a similar way to how Bargeist started as like a group of NUSA
soldiers,
militants that like defected essentially. The Sixth Street Gang was, I believe, formed by a former veteran.
Yeah, they're all vets.
Yeah,
Sixth Street. You have to be a vet to be in Sixth Street.
So there's a like it is weird being patriotic, but in a way, the initial goal of Sixth Street was supposed to be like the unofficial wing of the NUSA in Night City.
Yeah.
But with every system, such as with Bargeist and Sixth Street, they all started doing, you know, hyper illegal shit and, you know, screwing over the common men in the area.
Well, they again, because they are the sort of parallel society that's grown up where the government has failed, they both do some, in a big air quotes, positive things while also doing a lot of bad shit. Which you could argue a lot of actual governments do too, but like when people are completely failed, that's where these organizations thrive. The only gangs that don't really have a territory are like the animals, because they just hang out wherever. The service they provide is muscle, I guess.
Yeah, the animals are just like your muscle. If you need a big burly person,
you need a big guy.
You know, you need your dommy mommy to come in and help.
Look, Rhino's cool.
Animals lady.
Yeah, Rhino. Rhino's cool. The one she's in like the Beat the Brat stuff.
Yeah.
She
rules.
Enormous.
I love her. As any listener to my
guest. That's not your favorite character, Aurora.
Look, there's a lot of competition in this game, okay? Okay. And the less we say about the Voodoo Boys, the better. So the Voodoo Boys, while they do a lot of the interpersonal violence that you expect from a lot of the other gangs, it's bad, right? The Voodoo Boys are doing something that's really bad on like the next level, because we talked about sort of the danger presented by the Black Wall and rogue AIs to like humans now that we're entirely online. The Voodoo Boys are like always trying to pierce the Black Wall to just like let the rogue AIs in. So they're like pretty actively often presenting an existential threat to humans.
Well, funnily enough, like,
flat out, which is real bad. And I would argue is worse than what a lot of the other gangs are doing.
Yes. But funnily enough, when you're playing Phantom Liberty, you find out that there's several factions of the Voodoo Boys, and the Pacifico faction is the one that's like trying to do that specifically, not the ones in like Dogtown or anything.
Well, the ones in Dogtown are often the ones that ran from the Pacifica faction, but
yeah,
like Slider or whatever his name is. So yeah, as we're talking about these, we're talking about theme and setting, and the setting is you have a government and you have cops, but they don't do anything. They're very much the example of we are powerless to help you, but not powerless to punish you. Which is the Night City cops, and are often described directly as just being a gang.
Yeah, they're a gang that is indirectly or sometimes directly supported by the corporations that exist.
And the corporations also support their own pet other gangs.
Yeah, like Arasaka has the Tiger Claws. You know,
The Valentinos work with Militech sometimes.
Padre doesn't like that.
But they still do.
Yeah.
Sixth Street, I think Sixth Street's pretty unambiguously like under the pay of Militech.
Yeah, and you see like this is all within the backdrop of a corporation war that's about to start up too.
Well, you've had corporate wars in the past. Again, one of the things the setting of Cyberpunk does, again, the setting was created by a tabletop game designer named Mike Pondsmith.
Who's that from? And
yes. Which is great, and I think is reflected in the demographics of the story. And I think we can talk about that in a minute, that this work tends to be a lot more racially diverse than you might expect from a lot of other works. And that's because it was created not by a white guy. But the other thing we haven't touched on is the overweening corporate power, where like the American government is sort of a like a direct just partner with a company called Militech, which is just an arms manufacturer / paramilitary. Well, it's not even paramilitary. They're just a military.
Essentially Raytheon.
Yeah, it's just like Raytheon. And then the opposing main corporation is Arasaka, which just is the government of Japan, I think. I think they just are the government of Japan. And there have been wars in the past that were essentially, they seemed to be war. They were like, it was technically a war of like unification of like the new USA trying to reunify the America as a company or as a country. But it was essentially a proxy war between Arasaka and Militech, of which Night City emerged as a weird independent state, more or less. It's a neutral ground. That does lead me though into one of the things that, Cyberpunk as a setting does that stems from the very beginning of cyberpunk as a genre, which is sometimes fine and sometimes seems kind of weird, is that the biggest player in the game is always Japanese. There's a very, very strong orientalism to cyberpunk as a genre. And 2077 does not escape that at all. In fact, it leans into it in a lot of the time.
And
this started all the way back in Neuromancer.
I was going to say, because it picks it back up on those themes that you mentioned of the time with Japan's, you know, having its golden age post-war.
Mm-hmm.
Where, like, you know, they're coming up economically. So the fears are led into that. And because the game came out during that, or, you know, the original tabletop game came out during that time period, it makes sense that this, you know, all the themes kind of remain, especially, you know, with Neuromancer leading into that. So you have this, like, you know, neo-Japanese empire, you know, corporate empire kind of overtaking everything.
Like, all cyberpunk always goes back to the weird, like, oh, the big enemy are the Japanese zaibatsus who, like, secretly rule. And you're like, okay. It's just a weird hangover from like the 80s and into the 90s, where like the big American paranoia was Japan.
I kind of love the, like, it very clearly dates the original creation of this, but I kind of love how this is always a through line, I think it's really interesting to always see that stuff that was created in the 80s and the 70s and the 80s will almost always have Japan as some sort of big economic power, and the Soviet Union will still exist.
Yeah, because the Soviet Union still exists in cyberpunk.
Duh!
Like, you don't really interact with them aside from a few specific missions, but they are there.
I will say, it's just touching on the Soviet Union and Russia, because, you know, Tsar power, me being from Tsar power, there is a character who you have in a trunk named Alexander Pushkin, who's Russia's, like, father of literature, and I die every time I see him. I'm like, yes, what should I do with you? This last playthrough, I just gave him straight to the whoever it was, because I was like, oh,
the tiger claws, yeah.
Yeah, I open the trunk, and I'm like, never mind. Close.
This game is awash in Easter eggs and references. Like, everywhere you look, there's like a reference to another book or to another video game or to a piece of literature.
Authors.
It's all over the place. I will say, in some media, I find that tiresome, that everything is like a reference. Like, I hate Ready Player One. I think it's awful because it's all just like, hey, remember this. Hey, remember that. And it's like pure like nostalgia fan service,
because it's right in front of your face. You know,
it doesn't bother me as much when cyberpunk does it. I feel like cyberpunk is also one of those genres that gets to be self-referential, because at least in the way that their world is constructed, a lot of cyberpunk media that we know would have existed in the cyberpunk 2077 universe. Like the fact that there's a motorcycle that looks like Akira's motorcycle that's called the Kusanagi, which is a Ghost in the Shell reference. Yep. Like the timelines didn't diverge before those works existed. So they would have existed in the world. So it is somewhat logical that someone later down the line would be like, yeah, I'm going to make a motorcycle that looks cool and is named after a Ghost in the Shell character.
Speaking of Ghost in the Shell, tattoo.
Oh, I'm gonna get that tattoo. Don't you worry about it.
Yeah, the Judy
tattoo. You know the one Judy has that's literally a ghost coming out of a seashell, which it took me forever to realize was a Ghost in the Shell reference.
Ghost in the Shell.
It literally is just a ghost in a shell, which I didn't realize until too long.
And then when you call her, that's her like symbol too.
Yeah, her little call symbol is a ghost in a shell, which took me forever to realize. But
I think we realized it around the same time, actually. Yeah.
But, so like, I guess it doesn't, that was just, it's a side note, but it doesn't bother me when this game is as sort of like referential as other works can be. You know what I mean? Like it feels more appropriate.
And for me, because it's based more in like, as you mentioned, reality, or, you know, in our world, I enjoy it a lot more because if I see some of that stuff, and let's say like The Witcher, I'm like, really? But like here, I'm like, yeah, this makes sense. Why wouldn't they have this stuff in here?
This kind of follows in a long line of, I don't know what it is about futuristic sci-fi stuff that is okay with having a crap ton of references in it. But I think it's kind of what you're getting at. It's just because I think of Cyberpunk, of this game just being absolutely chock full to the ninth degree on, and then I think about any other franchise that I'm like, where else does it work? And I think of Fallout.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Fallout New Vegas. You have the guy in a fridge of a fedora.
Yeah, it's like there's these weird, ludicrous things in it that, because of the idiosyncrasies of the setting, are fine. Like, they're perfectly okay. And they're never put in there in such an obvious way that you... It's not like you're seeing people walk around on the street, like in Ready Player One, with an avatar that's Link.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And you're like, it's a Legend of Zelda reference. They're going to like sneak a Zelda reference. And I bet you there is one in Cyberpunk somewhere.
Sure.
Like they're going to sneak it in and have some character who has a bunch of guitars. And one of the guitars is going to have the Triforce on.
Yeah. It's not as immersion breaking. It's not as in your face. Well, like, you know, like nearly every mission in this game is... The name of the mission is a song title. It's a song. Yeah. Basically, every mission is a song.
That's something that immediately made me be like, oh, is this like Fallout New Vegas? It's like it's just constantly.
It's that sort of thing, which I think is it's fun, but it's not as immersion breaking as you are in like Ready Player One, where it's like, hey, remember this? It's more like, yeah, again, like my example is you happen to buy a motorcycle and you're like, oh, it looks like the Akira motorcycle and it's called the Kusanagi.
I also really appreciate the places they're getting the music from for their options. Like it makes sense. And this also kind of goes back to New Vegas, but it's a similar thing where they're thinking about the aesthetics of the songs they're picking. Like we mentioned Beat on the Brat. It's like, that's a Ramones song.
Mm-hmm.
So they're picking punk music for the most part. And classic rock and stuff that makes sense in line with that, just like Fallout New Vegas was making songs like picking songs like Jailhouse Rock quests. I appreciate that. I appreciate the little notes.
I mean, and it makes sense when you have a little rocker boy in your head. So
yeah. And cycling back a little bit though, before you get too far away, like the Orientalism of the game, like I said, sometimes in The Last Cyberpunk that can be kind of problematic because it feels a little
nose
Orientalist, right? Like it's not good a lot of the time. Maybe it's just my bias because I did enjoy this game. I feel like Cyberpunk doesn't make it as weird, but I think that's partly mediated by the fact that the entire game is a lot more
diverse
and multicultural than other cyberpunk media. A lot of other cyberpunk stuff, you've got the white people and the Japanese. Mm-hmm. And it's very like us and them, which is obviously bad. 2077, the entire setting is so multicultural that it doesn't feel as exploitative or
like
exotic to have Japanese people around. You know what I mean? Because there's if you're cycling through sort of the people you interact with the most between V, the fixers, the main NPCs. Well, obviously V is whatever V looks like, whatever you want them to look like.
My V was Hispanic. So
yeah. If you look at like, let's start, if you work from the top down to so like fixers, you've got
Mr. Hands, who's white.
Mr. Hands and Dino?
Yeah.
Regina.
Regina's not white. She's like some sort of Asian descent.
Oh, I didn't realize.
So she's of some sort of, you know, East Asian descent. You have Wakako, obviously, who's Japanese. You've got the Padre, who is Hispanic. Mm-hmm. You have
El Capitan, who's also Hispanic.
The Capitan, who's also Hispanic. You have Dakota, who, like all like a lot of the nomads, has a very like sort of Native American like mm-hmm. extraction. You look at like major NPCs, like all of like your love interests and major NPCs. River's
Puerto Rican, I think, or like
no, they're indigenous.
Or they're indigenous.
Mm-hmm. River's family is
okay.
You have Carrie, who's Filipino.
Yep.
Judy, who's Hispanic, and Pan Am, who is. I think that one's a little bit more ambiguous, but she's not white.
She's not white, no, because her hair is very curly.
Basically, all of the people you interact with on a regular basis aren't white, and the game is the one white person you interact with, the one white person you always interact with is fucking Johnny.
That's a good example of a white person too, because I want to punch him in the face sometimes. Yeah.
And I don't mean this in like it's non-white, so it's better. But like the game is better for it because you have a mix of cultures and opinions and people, and it feels less exploitative because this is how a real city would be. Like even though it's not where it is, this is essentially like cyber future LA, right? It's not in LA. LA still exists in the cyberpunk. It's a new city, but that's pretty a lot of what its setup was kind of modeled on.
It is a Southern California city.
It's more middle California. It's in Morro Bay. I've been there. I took a picture.
It's in Morro Bay, but like it has the feel of a Southern California city. It's why you have such a large Hispanic influence and a large Asian influence because of where it's located. But like the game is better for it because of its diversity. Like,
no, and that's what made it me enjoy this game so much, because as a Hispanic man, I've never been able to play a game where one of the main characters, my best friend, being Hispanic. And I'm like, is this why I connected with Jackie so much?
In the game.
The coolest guy in the game, yeah, Jackie.
Yeah, the coolest guy in the game. Your literal best friend in the game. And I'm like, I love this man so much, and he is a treasure because it is Hispanic representation that I've never seen in a video game ever. Yeah,
and if you start as a street kid, coming from my perspective anyway, being street kid almost felt familiar to me. I'm white, but I grew up in a city that has a large Hispanic population. A lot of my friends and neighbors growing up were Hispanic because of the city I lived in. My street kid V felt very familiar because you just grew up being like the one white kid in the Hispanic neighborhood where everyone's cool with you, but you're just kind of there like, hey.
Yeah, and you're you pick up some like Spanish slang, and you're like, yeah, I understand this. Yeah.
Like I used to know like a significant amount of weird like Spanish slang because that was all of my neighbors, and like half the kids in my elementary school growing up were Hispanic, mm-hmm. and you feel that way. I felt that way doing like the street kid V start. You know what I mean? And like you said, for you, you just having Hispanic representation again among like this core central cast of characters. You have Jackie. And you have Judy.
Mm-hmm. Mind-boggling to me, this game was made by a bunch of white people in Poland.
It was made by a bunch of Polish people.
Well, they were discriminated against, too, for being Eastern European.
Yeah, but like also, Poland, not that racially diverse.
No, but it just shows a commitment that you can still have a group of people who put the time and effort into understanding cultural norms and everything. And make it part of the society and not just a, oh, we need to add this just because we have to, but more so because this is what people find to be comforting and homelike.
It's also setting appropriate. Like this is what, if this place were real, this is what the demographics would look like.
Because if I played this game and everybody was white, and I'm like, are we in California? Are you sure? Like,
like,
sure,
I don't even,
you sure this isn't Wisconsin?
Like, like I said, I think also having it be genuinely diverse, mm-hmm, makes it feel less weird when you're like, oh, we have to hang out with fucking with Takamura and do like the parade. You know, it doesn't feel like they're objectifying Japanese culture nearly so much because the game incorporates a lot of different cultures. Where like if it was just white Californians and the Tiger Claws, it would be weird.
Mm-hmm. And even like being able to like go through different districts, you can get the feel of like, oh yeah, this is a very heavily Hispanic district. This is very Asian. This is, you know, such and such.
And you, I'm get like, to go to Pinche. You get to go to Pinche Pollo.
Yeah, Pinche Pollo. it's like you go to different places, and it feels like you're able to be a part of everything, and not just a, oh, we're, this is just for show. It's like, no, you walk in, there's people speaking Spanish. You know, it's people speaking their native languages, which for me was like mind-boggling when I first came into this game. And I'm like, holy shit, they're speaking Russian. Holy shit, they're speaking Spanish. Holy shit, that's Japanese. That's Chinese. Holy shit, what the fuck?
Jackie speaks Spanish all the time in Act 1.
Yeah.
It's so well integrated into the setting because you have cyberware that
translates,
automatically translates it for you, so you, it translate, it'll show up in the subtitle and then
no, that's actually translate. Really well game designed, because it shows up in Spanish or whatever the language is, and then it translates it for you, so you get to see both. But they do also strategically leave some words untranslated, which is always really funny.
Oh no, I love and hate it when they do that.
Yeah, it's almost like the cyberware predicts when Jackie wants it to not be translated.
Yes. Yeah. It's like almost has intentionality. He's like, no, this is a curse word that I need to be in Spanish, please.
And yeah, what I really enjoy about that is that they don't fall into that trap of someone speaking a, you know, foreign language and then immediately translating it afterwards.
Yeah, no.
Because no, nobody speaks like that. I'm not going to say, oh, Ben, not that one. oh, Pinche puto, like, you know, you're fucking whore, like, you know, they don't, you do don't, that. You don't,
yeah, people don't say it in their own language and then say it in English. That's not how that works. So the exactly. game does that. The game does that for you by just doing it in the subtitles. It's great. It's fine. And like, you can even make jokes. There's even some missions where V gets to make jokes like, can you do this? And V's just like, I don't speak that language. Like,
yeah,
it's like of all the languages, like all the languages in Night City, I don't speak Haitian Creole.
Yeah, I don't like, and they're like, you need to upload that into your data term. And I'm like, okay, cool, I can auto translate languages now. And then sometimes it just doesn't translate half of the freaking thing, anyways. And you're like, what?
It's like real life.
Yeah,
like using Google Translate, and it's like, are you speaking in Ukrainian? Albanian?
Yeah, like, I don't, whatever. But, like, again, also talking about in terms of, like, acceptability and accessibility, we talked about sort of race and culture. There's also no, one thing Night City does have going for it is, like, there's complete, like, gay acceptance in Night City. No one bothers you for like being gay, and like a lot of people are, and not just like it. It's not even like a player sexual choice like you get in some games where you as the player can choose to be if you want. Like a lot of NPCs are just like diegetically as part of the game, and it's not like, it's never judged, at least by the society you're in. Like when you have to do the mission where you go see a sex worker at Clouds, they just go, well, do you want the guy or the girl? Pick one. And there, it's not them going like, you know, being like, well, you got the girl, but I mean, you can pick a guy if you want, or vice versa. They're just like, yeah, whatever. We cater to everybody.
I love that in that mission that the thing that was most weird about it was, oh, you match of two people. That's interesting.
Yeah, there's like, that's interesting. But like, there's no like in, you don't really encounter anyway, any like in universe, like homophobia or bigotry.
Yeah, I saw none of that. And I was like, dang, this is what the world should be like.
And they like, they present the player with, no matter whether you play the male or female, like player character, you can pick a romance partner of either one.
Well, there, it does lock some depending on how you end up making your character. So
yeah, but that's, but you always, it gives you options.
Yeah.
Right. Like, so if you play as female V, you can be gay or you can be straight or you can be bi. If you play a male V, you can be gay or straight or bi. That those are options given to you. It's not like the Baldur's Gate thing where like you can romance anybody as anybody. The NPCs have personal preferences that you have to match, but it's, there's no like in-game weirdness where they're like,
we got a lesbian.
Like they don't do, the game doesn't do that, which I have to give it credit for, because a lot of other games, even when they have sort of like homosexual romances, can still feel a little exploitative at times, particularly lesbian romances can feel a bit exploitative in certain games. And they never felt that way to me in Cyberpunk, which is to the game and the writer's credit.
I will say the lesbian romance in this game is the best romance in this game.
I was going to get into that, because if it was for on that, we can transition, talk about that topic. Even though this game does give you a lot of options, a criticism is that both of the male love interests were done kind of dirty by the writers, one more than the other. If you've played the game, you know the love interest options. There's Judy, there's Pan Am, there's Carrie, and there's River. If you're a female V, you can be a lesbian with Judy, or you can be straight with River. If you're a male V, you can be straight with Pan Am or gay with Carrie. Okay. Both female romances, but I think Judy's above Pan Am's.
Oh yeah,
are incredibly well written. You build a relationship with this character over series and series of missions. Both Pan Am and Judy are actually integrated into the main quest line. You need to work with them for the main quests. You can then do a whole set of side quests specifically for them, where you build rapport, you establish a relationship. There are reasons why you're interacting and reasons why you have like built a relationship, right? Neither of the male interests are important to the main. You can finish the main storyline without ever interacting with either of the male love interests. You don't ever have to talk to Carrie. You definitely don't ever have to talk to River. You're also introduced to them much later in the game. You have less of a time to build a rapport with them and for that relationship to feel genuine. And so even though I'm happy because the lesbian romance with Judy is the most well-developed in the entire game, and it's great for me personally, I can see why if you were like a straight woman playing this game, you'd feel done kind of dirty, because River's not a great character.
They're not. And the fact that he's a cop with anger issues who got kicked off the force because of said anger issues is just like, to be an NCPD cop who gets kicked off the force.
He theoretically gets kicked off the force for like questioning the authority's handling of certain cases. But
after your character has a chance to say, hey, do not do that if you want to keep your job.
Yeah.
Anyways.
Also, actually, this is my contention. River's romance arc is bad, but it's written a lot like a straight man trying to romance someone.
Hey, hey, hey.
I'm sorry, but like the weird way too soon intimacy of some of his messages and the like, hey, we've worked together twice. Want to come over and fuck on my water tower after like six text messages and like two missions. How like weird and forward, and how despite, even if you pick all the options that are like, no, he still tries anyway, feels close to real life. And that's bad. It feels bad. Like, it feels really uncomfortable. if you're a woman and then you, this guy's like, come over, he sent you a bunch of sort of flirty texts. And every time you're like, no, eventually he's like, at least come over and see my family. We'll have dinner. And you're like, cool, fine, I'll do it. And then at dinner, they try to make you like raise your hand to say that you would make a good couple. And then he takes you alone to a secluded spot on top of a water tower and then pulls a gun.
I mean, he's giving you the gun, but it's terrifying at the same time. You're like, wait, what?
Do you know that? The second he pulls it? No. He takes you to a secluded spot, pulls a gun, offers you a drink, and says, hey, do you want to bang? And you're like,
if I had player control at that moment, I would have made him, you know, system collapse right then and there.
Like, you can see why it feels incredibly awkward. And I will say it does make me laugh, because then you have like dudes playing the game encountering that, and they're like, this feels really creepy and pushy. And you're like, yeah, yeah, it does. We put you through the woman dating simulator. Congratulations. It's fucking weird. But I don't know. You two can have other thoughts. I just feel like both male romance options are done kind of dirty by the writers because they're introduced too late and they're not given enough to do for the relationship to feel natural.
Well, I do have some, because originally reading back on like some of the notes, it was supposed to be River who saves you from the landfill, not Takemura. They brought in Takemura afterwards because they wanted you to have some sort of connection with Arasaka to get you to do the Arasaka route. So that's why it feels like it's a bit rushed, because you should have been doing these missions with River or something. But also, just kind of, you only do the two missions with River, and each time it's like you're investigating, you know, someone being murdered, and then you're trying to find his nephew. And it's like, okay, I helped you with this, but this isn't a bonding experience. I've saved people by myself doing this before. So like, I could have done this whole thing by myself and not need your help. And probably have gotten there faster.
Yeah, when River's like, oh, you know, it's like trauma bonding because we saved these kids. I'm like, I saved 11 people yesterday before lunch because of the nature of my job. You know what I mean? Like, for V, rescuing the kids from that farm is like what V does for a living.
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't feel as like...
It doesn't feel as like trauma bonding, because like, no, I've been through worse trauma because I've literally seen, you know, scavs cutting people up and trying to sell their parts. I've been to Maelstrom, you know, places. Like, this is nothing new for me. This is just like, yeah, this kind of sucks for the kids, but and you know, the serial killer's fucked up, but this is also another day, you know.
Sorry, Catho, do you have something? Sorry.
It is just really disappointing that they don't have any tie into the main quests. It's like you're at least heavily encouraged to go see Carrie, but yeah. River is just totally a side quest without any, like, you could completely ignore that for a long time.
All you have to do is never do the first Perales quest.
Yeah.
Which is optional, and you'd never encounter River ever.
Well, and here's the thing. I forgot I had it, and I was like, I haven't done the Perales quest yet. Where's River? And I'm like, oh, shoot, I never called him. Because guess what? It doesn't show up as a marker on your map. It only shows up in your journal. So,
yeah, whereas like, yeah, because she contacted you to ask you to do work for her.
Yeah.
So, but like you said, Ketho, Carrie, at least you're strongly encouraged to start the quest chain that leads you to him. Because Johnny is like, I need to go see Rogue, please. Which is what starts chipping in.
Which, you know, gets you the full set of Johnny armor. So,
yeah, also like you need to do chipping in if you want to get one of the endings. So,
yeah. So if you want to do the give body to Johnny,
if you want to do the secret ending, the don't fear the Reaper ending, you need to do chipping in because the check to get that ending available to you happens while you're in the oil field where Johnny's body got dumped.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to say the exact right thing to do it. But like, so if you never do chipping in, you're never going to do that. You know what I mean? And also, if you don't do chipping in, you don't get the option to call Rogue after you meet for the ending, right? That's not one of the ending options available to you. So like, you're encouraged to do the quest chain that eventually leads you to Carrie. I do also think the Carrie romance has a little weirdness to it, because to me, it always felt like
A fling?
Well, it feels like a fling, which, and flings are fine, but the fling feels weird because I feel like Carrie is displacing his attraction to Johnny onto you.
And I think that's what it is, because if you, because he sees you as Johnny, and he's, every time he calls, he's like, hey, is this Johnny? And it's like, no, it's V.
So like, he's not like hooking up with you necessarily because he likes you. He's hooking up with you because to him, it's like a proxy for his feelings about Johnny, which I think is kind of weird.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird. Both of the male romance options also get weird responses from Johnny himself.
Well, Johnny's, at least for River, is understandable. He's like, this cop's trying to fuck you, and I don't want to do that.
Right, no, but he legitimately says to you afterwards, I can't believe you made me fuck a cop.
which, honestly, doing that to Johnny was a fun bit, but...
I mean, the only good bit about that is that he says that, and then you do get a t-shirt that says, fuck the police.
Yes, which is great.
Not worth it, though.
No.
And then, I don't know, I've never done the Carrie one. What's he say if you hook up with Carrie?
I never done that one, because I never got that far with a male V.
I was playing, I haven't gotten there with male V. So, and if I do have male V, why would I not romance Pan Am?
Yeah, because that's the option. If you have a male V, you're romancing Pan Am because she's a fucking ride or die.
Yeah, literally, call her. I need a favor. Sure. Okay, what? That was quick.
See, the thing with the writing is, like, Judy's a great partner if you're, like, female V. Like, she's, like, sensitive and helpful, and, like, you build a rapport and a relationship with her, and you help her through a lot of shit, and, like, it makes sense. Pan Am is great no matter which gender character you're playing, because as a guy, you know, she's a cool romance partner, and she's a lot of fun. And as a girl, she is, like, an instant bestie, mm-hmm. right? Like, as a girl, you know, you can call her and be like, hey, I'm having some trouble. And she's like, I'll be there in 5 minutes.
Especially coming from the Badlands. How did you get to Watson that quick?
Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. But like, and
he was going 125.
And even outside of the ending, throughout the game, Pan Am will just text you and just be like, yo, heard some shit was going down. What's up with you? You know what I mean? Like, she just hits you up with messages to see mm-hmm. how you're doing. She'll just text you and be like, just text you back, how are you doing? Which is not something they do with most of the other characters.
There are multiple interactions in Phantom Liberty where you get the option to reach out to some of your past contacts in order to get certain quests done. Mm-hmm.
There's one for Judy for sure.
I've never hit any of those quests.
You get to talk to Judy during the
The
Phantom Liberty mission where the guy gets the BD, scrambles his brain.
Yes, okay, I did do that. Yes, I talked to Judy. And she's like, "What kind of stupid gonk are you?" And I'm like, "No, it wasn't me."
Then you get the option in one of the quests for one of the Bargist goons. Like, he's kind of dumb, and you get to play as what's his name in the flashbacks?
Kurt Hansen,
the leader of Bargist.
Yeah.
You get to play as Hansen. I almost said Chris Hansen.
Caught a pedo.
Yeah. But no, you get to play as Kurt in his little, like, drug trips.
Yeah.
I think his name's Pablo.
In order to get Pablo either out of there or a new set of generators so that he doesn't get killed, you can either call River to get the generators, or you can call Pan Am to get them the hell out of there,
mm-hmm.
To smuggle them out of Night City.
That's where I fucked up. Mm-hmm. I just said, hey, let's just blame it on the lieutenant. And then he's like, oh shit, he's dead.
So you can call Pan Am like in that and help. You can even call River, like you said. You can't call Carrie for anything. But we're talking about writing. Pan Am gets her own dedicated ending to the game.
And if you're dating Judy, it's the best ending for Judy too.
Yeah,
it is. Like, as we all did, if you're dating Judy, it is the best ending for Judy. It's the best ending for you as V, and it's one of the. It's the best ending for like Pan Am and her people, and it's like those happen with those love interests. If you're dating River, and the end of the game, and you like either leave the city or do whatever, his life doesn't go well. First off, he won't come with you if you leave the city, number one. And number two,
so he doesn't love you that much.
Any of the other ones where you like, if you like disappear for a while and come back, pretty sure if you do the one where you go to the moon for like 2 years to get cured and come back, he's like dead when you come back because he got into some weird shit, like dealing arms or something. Like his life doesn't go super well. And he basically just like, I get by, I guess, if you leave the city.
And even in the ending where you do go with Judy and Pan Am, he's like, yeah, I'm getting into arms dealing. And I'm like, are you an idiot?
Yeah. He's like, I follow your example. I'm dealing arms now. And you're like, what? That's not what I did.
That's nothing like what I did.
And also, Carrie, at least I understand why he wouldn't leave. He's like a legitimate rock star.
Yeah, and he's going on a tour anyways with the Uscracks. So it's like, who I love, by the way.
Yeah, Uscracks is great. I listen to Pon Pon shit unironically.
Same.
But like, Carrie, at least I get why he wouldn't go with you, and it's why it's like just a fling. He's also like 80 years old. Carrie is also way... Talk about some age gap discourse. V is in their 20s. Carrie is like in his 80s.
Is that canon that V's in her 20s?
So it depends. I think when the game first came out, V was canonically like 27. But then eventually, the way it is now, if you look at the wiki, V is supposed to be like 23.
Interesting.
Which I don't really like. I think 27 sounds way better, personally. I think that fits better.
27 Club reference. Come on.
It's also 27 Club reference. Carrie, like Rogue, is in his 80s. Pan Am is supposed to be like 32. Judy's like 23, I think. River, I think in his 30s, maybe something like that. 30s or 40s,
which is like my head canon is like V was in like, you know, 20, late 20s.
Yeah. I always felt like 27 felt about right for the life experience your character has.
Yeah. I wouldn't feel like any younger than 27 would make that much sense. I could see someone being like, oh, she's 32. And it would make sense.
Anywhere in like the late 20s to early 30s makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Also, I think it depends on your start, because if you're Corpo V, it makes no sense for Corpo V to be 23.
No, especially if you're that burnt out on the verge of cyberpsychosis.
Like, you should be in your late 20s, early 30s. Nomad V, I think, should be in her like late 20s because you've already lived a significant portion of your life as a nomad. I think the only one that kind of makes sense to be in your early 20s is Street Kid V.
Because off to Atlanta for a bit and then you come back.
2 years. So like, that's the only one that makes sense being young. But again, we'll do some joke about some internet age gap discourses. Trying to date Carrie, who is literally like 85 years old, mm-hmm. or whatever. Now, age is a bit weird, more stretched out in cyberpunk because implants and people stay a lot younger because Rogue is also in her 80s. But like, it's weird.
No, very. I think it's like romancing Carrie was like kind of uncomfortable for me. I'm like, you're like 60 years my senior. Like, at least. Yeah. Like, this is gross. And then whenever you know, Johnny's trying to like romance Rogue but fails, and I'm like, I don't know if I like this, Johnny.
Well, you get why Johnny wants to do it, because Johnny is her age. Like, yeah.
Well, not really.
Well, sort of.
Yeah, it's like 40-year-old Johnny instead of, or 25. It's like 25-year-old Johnny instead of.
Yeah. Yeah, late 20s, Johnny.
If you're not age-wise, he would have to be early 30s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When they storm Arasaka Tower, yeah. And
back in like 2020?
Yep.
2023, yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
2023.
And it's 2077?
So like, yeah, like Samurai had already had a career as a band by the time Johnny dies. So like Carrie and Denny and them are all like in their 80s.
At least.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think even though the writing for like Pan Am and Judy is really good, and I want to give them credit for writing an incredibly good, like, you know, like lesbian romance, it's incredibly touching. It's good. It's really well done. They just didn't give any of that energy to any of the male romance options. It's got none of it. So like, if you're a straight woman or a gay man, I'm sorry.
Yeah. At least, you know, even with just despite the age thing of Carrie, I thought, you know, it's like, yeah, this is a good, like, you have a fling with him and then you're kind of done. But one thing I did enjoy that they added with the new like 2.1 or 2.2 was to bring your partner to your apartments.
Really want to stay at your house. The little dates you can go on.
Yeah.
You can bet I'm going on that date. So what I do is I just wait for Judy to send the text saying, hey, I want to hang out. Because then it happens like canonically within game. It happens like every like 3 or 4 days or something like that, which feels right. But no, those little hangouts are cool. They have a bunch of little scripted events. You can like dance with your like loved one. Every apartment has a different weird little activity you can do depending on which apartment you're in. It's great.
You know, and I really enjoy it because like sometimes you can say, hey, meet me at this place. And then you come back, you have candles everywhere and you're, you know, your relationship partners, your romance partners like, there. And I'm like, wow, you're here.
You go to your apartment and Judy has like sent you like pizza, and the pizza she sends is all dependent on the pizza you chose back in one in her mission before you take over Clouds. Do you know that?
Yeah.
When Judy says what's your favorite pizza when she's ordering it before you go meet everyone at her apartment, that's what she orders to send to your apartment for like the rest of the game when you go home and there's like a slice of pizza ready for you. It's whatever you chose.
It's so heartwarming.
Way, but she's way better at remembering her partner's preferences than I've ever been in my life. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Same.
all my partners.
I'm like, you're eating what I make today. Sorry.
But that good stuff aside, you guys, you ready to talk about? Ready to talk about some morality? Talk about some endings? Talk about some of the more like heavier sort of themes going on that we've talked about the game sort of at like its surface level and acceptance and stuff.
Yes, but would you like to do and make this part one?
Yeah, it'll get broken up wherever I decide to break it up in editing.
All right, sounds good. Cut this out.
I'm not going to decide right now because, you know what I mean? It might be natural here, it might not. We'll find
out. Okay, no worries.
Bro. Are you fucking real, man? Come on.